to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on
red light.
Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
All right, well, if you've been watching Squid Game, you have a completely different relationship with that song than you used to have. And Squid Game, which is currently the biggest Netflix hit, possibly, maybe, ever, it's sort of hard to tell, 111 million viewers, excuse me. I think it's the biggest Netflix hit in 90 different countries. That doesn't mean you've watched it, but if you have anyway, you know that anything, including that very lovely jazz standard, can be perverted and twisted around into a commentary on the futility of human endeavor or something like that. Joining us to explain this far more coherently than I am doing right now are our two panelists on the nose today. Tanisha Dugan is director, producer, and arts consultant. Rebecca Castellani is the co-founder of Quiet Corner Communications and a freelance writer. We have been watching Squid Game. It is an enormous hit. I will quickly attempt to summarize it. Well, I'll use Netflix's own summary. A mysterious invitation to join the game is sent to people at risk who are in dire need of money. 456 participants from all walks of life are locked into a secret location where they play the games in order to win 45.6 billion won. Every game is a Korean traditional children's game, such as red light, green light, but the consequence of losing is death. Who will be the winner? What is the purpose behind this game? Some of this we will not be telling you, but some of it we will. So, I don't know. I don't even know exactly how to begin, so I'll begin in my usual sort of formless, blundering way. So, Tanisha, first of all, are you finding this show as gripping as apparently a huge portion of humankind is?
I am not. this show had been sort of playing in, as like the wallpaper to my life for the past couple of weeks, because every really male identifying person in my house had like found out about Squid Game and not at the same time. So they were watching it kind of like in a domino fashion. So I actually was like eager to be like, what is everyone watching? And then I did, and I was like, oh, I wish Bridgerton had held on to that title of most watched show on Netflix. While I think I really dig what is happening in South Korean cinema and television right now, and it did sort of pique my interest, and I was checking out a New Yorker magazine, and there's like a laundry list, I think, of other Korean films and television shows that I want to check out now. This one didn't quite hit the go button for me.
And I also sort of wonder about that sometimes, because Squid Game has kind of moved into the conversation to a point where last week on Saturday Night Live, there were inevitable Squid Game jokes. Actually, on Sunday, of all things, the Fox Sports NFL pregame noon show had a comedy segment based on Squid Game in which it was all kind of transferred over into NFL dramas. I mean, just Squid Game is kind of everywhere, Tanisha. And I remember I waited too long to see the movie once. And everybody was just getting really excited about Once. You know, that's the sort of the two musicians in Dublin or wherever they are. And by the time I watched it, I went, this? This is what you're so excited about?
We're in complete
about?
Solidarity over Once as well.
But sometimes you just wait too long, I think, you know, and it can never measure up. Now, Rebecca, I know you went in the immersion tank on this one, right?
As I'm wont to do, yes. I binged the whole thing over the weekend. And unlike Tanisha, I was transfixed. I really, really liked it. I think it's helpful when something is not in English because I tend to pay more attention than when I've been asked, you know, formally to watch shows for this show. I will sometimes just put it out of the background and like pay less attention than I probably should be. So I was very captivated and also generally paying more attention than I typically do to television shows. And I thought it was great. I thought the performances were great. I loved the set design. I loved the sound choices. This is also very much in my wheelhouse of things I like. Like, I really go for dark dystopia, violent, twisted things. So I think this was really like absolutely targeted towards my interests. So I really loved it. I responded very positively to it.
Yeah, and I think I'm somewhere in the middle right now. I'm not all the way through it yet. I've been watching it with my son when I get together with him. So it's kind of a nice little bonding experience for us. And I do think that there are some things that can recommend it, you know. And I do, I mean, Tanisha, we had a little conversation in our emails about whether it has any meaningful relationship to Parasite, which might be the other piece of South Korean filmmaking or television making people are most recently familiar with. And to me, it did. One of the things that Parasite helped me understand and go do more reading about is that the kinds of economic inequalities that were very familiar with here in the United States are, if anything, exacerbated in terms of tiers of have-nots and haves in South Korea. And to me, the economic desperation, I mean, one thing that we can kind of tell you without spoiling anything is once they've discovered in the first episode that this game is very, very sinister and you know, that elimination in this game is a literal truth, in the second episode, most of them are returned to their lives in Seoul and other North Korean cities, and most of them elect to go back. And somehow or other, that doesn't seem completely crazy. and some of it is just because of the incredible economic desperation that we see. So I don't know whether this is a piece of escapist fare, Tanisha, that I'm plastering too many interpretations on top of, or whether that actually is. I know that North Korea has condemned it or said, this shows you why capitalism doesn't work. Squid Game, that's yes. North Koreans' take on that. But I don't know. Where did you wind up on that?
I mean, I think you're probably right, and I think that's probably why I'm turned off by it. And I do think that there are some parallels in terms of themes and conversation that Parasite and Squid Game are attempting. And I will go back and agree with Rebecca that I think design-wise, I mean, it's wonderful, and I think that's also just a part of the aesthetic of South Korean film. I have yet to see something that's not visually specific and
agreed.
And purposeful and beautiful. But I think you're right. I think, you know, this project gets at inequity and the ways in which we are navigating inequity in a very visceral and brutal way. And maybe my subconscious protection is saying, ooh, this is really close. What does it mean if all of this is entertainment for the rich? I don't think that's a spoiler. I should have advanced that with the spoiler. but I think that's the sort of question for me. And is the desperation of the working class, of the indebted, is that entertainment? And is there enough for me as a viewer? There's not quite enough education or redemption in it. For it to keep me going, because while it's beautiful, it is brutal. It is brutal.
But I think that's the point, right? Like, you don't get redemption in capitalism. The wheel keeps on turning. We continue to use the lower classes as fodder for the rich's entertainment. Like, I think that brutal, uncompromising portrayal of life is the point of the show. And that's hard to watch and hard to swallow, but I think it's reality.
I think also it's interesting. I mean, I may be forcing a Papoulian through line here where there isn't one. But our second topic today, which will be later in the show, we're going to be talking about the now kind of notorious Bad Art Friend article in the New York Times and all of the fallout from that. And it, of course, is kind of a meditation, as the title would suggest, on the nature of friendship. And one of the things this thing seems to be about is, you know, how we forge alliances to get through things and whether those alliances work and who's trustworthy and who's not. One of the things that I have kind of liked, and this is my birthday today, so I think maybe I'm having
happy birthday! Well,
happy birthday! Wow!
And as you get older, you notice more about how old people are portrayed on things. And so there's this grizzled old guy whose name is Oh Young-soo, and you know, he's a little bit out of it. Maybe he's a lot out of it, but he's also treated as kind of a source of wisdom. And there's that kind of Asian thing of the veneration of older people, and people take care of him, but they also listen to him because he actually has some pretty important things to say. And you know, there are a lot of other examples of that, Tanisha, where the relationships within this completely bizarre and, for the most part, kind of artificial seeming environment you know, still kind of devolve to the human relationships we need to get through life.
It's true. And I think the commentary on the relationships as you get through the rest of the season. Yes, season. Tells a story of may, perhaps not the best of humanity. Although I will say the lead character, as sort of fumbling as he is to me, is actually quite redeeming and charming. And I am grateful for at least one character that sort of holds on to some kind of central humane force within the entire project. But I think you're right. I think, you know, it is a story about relationships and how we use them, leverage them, deny them. And it is a quite apt Papoulian thread to our next conversation, because I think that's, I think if anything, that may be the thing that's making people watch, right? As it sort of helps you metabolize these transactional relationships we're all in addition to the ones that aren't so transactional, that are actually relational, and the sort of osmosis between those two things as it relates to human relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, why is this thing a hit in 90 countries? I mean, well, first of all, I think they've marketed it very effectively. But also, Rebecca, there is that sense that a lot of these stories, they're kind of familiar stories. A lot of the characters, I mean, there's a gang of kind of brutish hedonist bullies who, you know, they're sort of very familiar, I think. Yeah. You know, there's just a lot of stuff that you can sort of watch and go, oh, well, yes, I am not trapped in a South Korean dystopian reality in which I'm very likely to be murdered and then put in a very lovely gift box looking thing and stuck into a crematorium. That doesn't happen to be what's happening to me right now, but I get it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think these are archetypes that we can identify in all of our human lives. And I think, unfortunately, that's where some of the translation issues came into play. As I've learned more about some of the shortcomings of the English subtitles, you get kind of a richer picture. And I think that the portrayal of these characters, for example, Mina, the kind of unhinged lady who's playing everyone off of each other, there's a line where she talks about how she is smart. But I guess in the translation, it's that she's smart but didn't get the opportunity to go to school. And that's apparently like a big trope in South Korea, people that are very intelligent but don't actually have the ability to afford an education. So there's little things like that that I think make it richer that I wish that I had seen. And I think that would allow us to identify even more of these archetypes that are already at play and kind of set it more in our personal lives. But yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that's what made it so accessible for me, is that, oh, I know these characters. I might not know their names. I might not recognize their specific economic disparity as it pertains to Korean culture, but I know who these people are.
Yeah, I mean,
you watched it in subtitles. I'm curious, Colin, did you watch it in subtitles or English dub?
I watched it. Well, we started out with just, it defaulted to dub. I don't like dubbing unless it's done really, really well. I didn't think it was done particularly well here. Now, one thing that we learned about a little bit this week is the difference between subtitles and closed caption. I think I've been watching closed caption, which we're now being told is not as accurate a translation as you get from subtitles. Some of the closed caption, I think, is almost kind of robotically generated. So, I'd be interested to know for both of you, Tanisha, how about you?
I did both. It depends on whether or not I was in mixed company. And I think the dubbing episodes that I watched were less satisfying. Mm-hmm. I think exactly for what you said, Colin, that it's just not done very well. So you feel like you're kind of watching anime, like live action anime. Mm-hmm. And I think the episodes where I listened to it in its natural language just lifted for me differently, because I wasn't watching physical acting juxtaposed with English dubbing, and it, which then became a different show altogether. But I am curious how American audiences are consuming it, because I think there is a difference between watching it dubbed and watching it in subtitles.
I mean, things that are not dubbed well, and that's most things, particularly things that are dubbed into English for this country, tend not to be dubbed well. And my understanding is that in European television and movies, the dubbing is done better. There are people who actually become kind of famous. They are become dubbing celebrities because they're so good at doing Harrison Ford or whatever it is that they're doing. So, it's usually a bad choice here to do that. Rebecca, what did you do? How did you handle this?
I started off with the dubbing and immediately hated it. It was very distracting, and I didn't think the voice acting was very good. So I switched to subtitles and did that for the rest of my watch. And I think the subtitles were the superior choice there, but I also think that from what I've read, the subtitles did not do a great job of capturing the actual dialogue, which I think is a bummer. And I was also reading that other subtitles, like the Spanish subtitles, are apparently more accurate. So it really was a consequence of the English subtitles that I think were problematic. And I really have never wanted to learn Korean more so I could go back and watch this and really capture everything.
Yes, that'll be a very peculiar incentive for people who want to learn Korean so they really get Squid Game.
Of cool about what you've offered in before we sort of move on to a different layer of this conversation. But what's interesting to me about what you've offered, Rebecca, is this idea that like culture is specific to its language and that like translation, while workable for like the macro storytelling, when it comes to the nuance of what something is trying to get across, hearing it in its native tongue is probably, to use your word, the superior way of getting into it. And as a culture maker, that's really curious to me, because I'm like, well, so does that mean, could there ever be a world culture? Could there? Or is the specificity and locality of culture necessary for it to really have its effect?
It's a really great question. I think we all acknowledge that there are words in most languages that are not easily translatable into other languages. But that's, I think, a problem right here, too, that, there's just sort of things that the different cultures talk about that have words for that are not. And I also think the Esperanto film movement, just never really took off. So, Rebecca, I mean, I think Tanisha raises a great question. Can we have global cinema and global streaming, or is it sort of doomed a little bit? Anyway, it's doomed maybe not to reach 100% of its goal.
Sure. But I think to try and to accept this culture and then like do the research and do the background, like I've spent all week learning about Korean society lots of things I didn't know before watching this. And if a television show can encourage you to learn more about the world we live in, like, I think that's a really positive thing. And if it's just the springboard that gets you there, why not? I mean, my favorite example of how specific I think this show is to Korean culture and where the translation missed is in one of the games, they play marbles. And the older man says, he's his gangabu, which in the subtitles translated to "we share everything." Whereas in the Korean, it's "there is no ownership between us." And that is such a critical difference and absolutely changes the whole structure of that episode. And I was devastated to learn that I'd missed that. But then I was like, wow, how interesting that that's the term. And then I started kind of investigating the term. So I think however you come to it, there is some external work you need to do to fully understand the story. And that might not be for everyone, but for me, I like nothing more than a show that makes me want to go research.
I mean, the thing that compensates, I think, is, as both of you said at the beginning of the conversation, there's something so visually compelling about this that can pull it out of language at times. And that visual component ranges from, these, sort of multicolored Sesame Street Escher staircases. That somehow or other exist in a world where you can all sort of see behind the scenes that this is this kind of crappy facility that has a couple of kind of like, very cool looking things in it. Obviously, the uniforms and costumes and these kind of magenta colored guards.
The haunting doll.
The haunting doll. I think also one of the things that helps this series a lot is a number of these actors are really impressive face actors. I mean, starting with Lee Jung-jae, who plays the nominal protagonist here, Ji-hun, He's this down on his luck, really degenerate gambler who turns out to have other kinds of positive qualities about him. But really, you know, a lot of these characters, a lot of these actors act so well, Tanisha, with their faces that, you know, maybe we're missing a word or two, but somehow or other, you know, there's other ways that actors communicate. You as a director would know that better than anybody.
I think that's the thing that didn't quite work for me, because they are such face actors, and I was like, oh, I wonder if that's the aesthetic of Korean acting, because American acting asks for something subtler, I think.
Yeah.
And so I kept watching them work and going, I don't know. and I think you're right, Rebecca, that there's a curiosity that wasn't quite awakened in me, but in talking to you, I'm like, oh, I should learn more about the aesthetic of acting, right, in South Korea, which apparently is very close to North Korea. Like, apparently they were once one country. Yeah. So I heard. But I think there are a lot of sort of new things to learn. And yes, Colin, the amount of sort of physical acting that the actors are doing allows you to sort of get the gist of the story without actually understanding word for word what is being said.
All right. We have to take a break here. It's Squid Game. Either watch it or take the risk of not getting a lot of jokes or understanding people's Halloween costumes when they come to your door. But the choice is yours. We have to take a quick break here. And so people are going to ask you to support this program and this station and the whole concept of public broadcasting. Please do it. Please do it during our hour. It helps us. It's the last day of the pledge campaign. Poor Cat Pastor is so exhausted. So please, this is your last chance to support us.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford Healthcare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important, because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
We are back. I hope you did pledge to support the show and the station. Meanwhile, we're about to take another deep dive into something which, yeah, conceivably is kind of related to some of the questions raised in Squid Game, but it's written in a very different way. This is an essay called Who is the Bad Art Friend? I think it's an essay. It's an essay, a reported essay, a feature article maybe. Who is the bad art friend? Art often draws inspiration from life, but what happens when it's your life? Inside the curious case of Don Dorland versus Sonia Larsen, this is a story which has spanned many, many years at this point. You know, there's an old saying about, which we brought up, I think, in connection with the series The Bridge, The Chair, excuse me, The Chair, which it was, you know, why are academic battles so vicious? Because the stakes are so low. Well, the stakes are even lower in the world of short story writers, you know. I mean, but two short story writers, Don Dorlan and Sonia Larson, have had a long-running battle, which is a very difficult thing to explain. Actually, Lily Tyson, the producer of this episode, who, by the way, I think partly because she's still trying to be at graduate school, bridled at the fact that this is a 10,000-word piece about this this odd little feud. Don Dorlan, one of the writers, donated a kidney in a non-directed donation and set up a private face group to talk about herself and her kidney that she donated. And it was a group of writers that she knew, including one named Sonia Larson. And Sonia, in a way that was unsatisfying to Dawn, didn't comment at all or say anything about the kidney donation until Dawn asked her. And it later turned out that Sonia was working on a short story called about a kidney donation recipient and a kidney donor who had some of the neediness and aggressive desire for validation that her quote-unquote friend, Dawn Dorlan, seemed to have. And things kind of spiraled from there. Dawn wound up feeling very betrayed by this. They sort of tried to resolve it with some back and forth conversations. Those didn't work. There were a lot of other third parties jumping in and say, guess what Sonia's doing now? Then it wound up with, you know, thousands of pages of discovery with multiple lawsuits all about this short story, which I can guarantee you is not. Well, now it'll probably be made into a movie. But but it was not going to, you know, justify the amount of fuss that was made about it. So, yeah, I don't know. Rebecca, get us going here. This seemed like an awful lot of sound and fury about not much, except that maybe like Squid Game also, we're finding some universal themes in all this, because this has turned into a viral internet thing where, you know, vast analyses are being done, not unlike the short story Cat Person.
Yeah, no, this is high art. Like this, it doesn't get better than this. Like, I can't believe I finally read it this morning because I had read all of these supplementary articles and I'm stuck behind the New York Times paywall. So I finally figured out if I used my iPad, I could get into it. But this was everywhere. It was on Reddit everywhere. All my news feeds had, are you the bad art friend? Are we all the bad art friend? Thought pieces going on. So I was so intrigued by this. And I finally read it this morning, all 10,000 words. And I was like, this is glorious. This is what pop culture has been building towards. The stakes are the floor. It couldn't be lower. These two women are just equally insufferable and have committed various crimes against each other. But the fact that like we as a civilization are so hungry for gossip and tea, but we're also so burnt out of high stakes drama, whether it's a pandemic or an election, that when we have these little moments of low stakes drama, it's like the best thing ever. Like everybody wants to get involved. It's cathartic. It has people talking, but like not about like big world issues that stress us out. It's like nobody's actually losing sleep over the squabbles between these two women, but we're all talking about it and thinking about it and unpacking these deep questions, these existential questions of friendship. I mean, that's art, baby. Like that's what it's designed to do. I think it's brilliant.
You know, I probably shouldn't read aloud from the emails that we share back and forth because this is all about talking. But sometimes Tanisha just puts something so marvelously. She says it's a way to metabolize how living together in America today works. Fragility, ownership, martyrdom, respect, recognition, and so on. And when you put it that way, Tanisha, these are big themes. You know, I mean, the stakes may be low, but the themes are big.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Rebecca, you nailed it, right? Like, because the actual incident is low stake, there's an opportunity to have kind of high stake conversations without any skin in the game, mm-hmm. which I think is really, really great. I mean, I laughed just by the title when you were like, let's read the bad art friend article. And I was like, oh my God, totally bad art friend. And then I read it and I was like, oh crap, maybe I should walk myself so strongly in that direction. And yet, right, art is absolutely a collaboration, right? I mean, yeah. My favorite thing that people say is like when musicians say, well, there's only 88 keys, right? Yeah. So there's only so many sounds in the Western musical canon, and let's be clear, there's only so many sounds that can be made. And so, you know, this story hits on all of those things. It is, I'm sure there's a group of feminists somewhere who are going to be annoyed with me, but it is kind of an old fashioned girl fight.
Yes.
Which is just delicious to watch, and not like a Real Housewives sort of over the top girl fight, but like really true, like, are we friends? Are we not friends? How do you treat me? Oh, you don't treat me well. It just kind of hits all the things. And this woman with the kidney, I mean, we didn't even really get into it, right? But just the choice to be like, I'm going to give up part of my body to anybody. Just going to like, is in and of itself a strange thing. I mean, maybe I'm alone in feeling that way, but it's just an odd thing to do. It feels very, I mean, I don't think it gets any more performative than that.
Stranger still to email someone being like, how come you haven't engaged in my private Facebook group about my kidney donation? Like, what? Well,
exactly. And the private Facebook group that is, it seems, to be curated towards a group of people she really wants to impress.
Yes.
Just also like, oh, very fascinating. This article, all 10,000 words of it, is worth a Sunday afternoon cup of coffee, tea situation. Yep. Because it's hilarious.
Yeah, I almost, you guys are doing such a great job. I feel like I should just step back and let the two of you keep talking. I'm really enjoying this. I do think that, yes, you know, she sort of violates Don Dorland, the kidney donor, kind of violates, I think it's Maimonides who says that the highest form of charity is the charity that nobody knows about, you know, something that you do that, you know, you don't ever seek or get credit for. You know, she's kind of the opposite. I mean, this kidney donation is only meaningful to her, it seems anyway, in terms of the amount of validation it attracts. It really is maybe the most organic, literally organic form of virtue signaling I've ever seen in my life. You know, it's like, let's talk about me. And yet, I don't know. To me, Rebecca, the word first of all, bad art friend is such a weird phrase. I don't know.
Yes.
I've never heard that phrase before. I think it's Sonia Larson, the person who writes the story about the other writer, who says, I think at one point in the essay, is she saying I'm a bad art friend? I thought, what the hell is that? But but I guess I'd like to ask both of you about that. Is there, I mean, so much of this, I think, is also about what is friendship. And when we're spending so much time in virtual contact with one another, in digital contact with one another, and not seeing, smelling, hearing, you know, each other in the ways that you understand who your friends are in this kind of, you know, much more pheromone-driven way, maybe it is a little bit about that question, too. It's like, you know, ordinarily, animals are always sniffing each other's butts and stuff like that, but you can't do that online. You can't really figure out where you stand with somebody. I don't know how that's a question.
The anxiety I had about the idea that all these people had a group text about this one woman, and all this woman wants is the validation of those specific people, like, sent me into an absolute panic spiral. Like, are there group texts about me? But I also feel like it's a testament to how awful writers are too. Like, the idea of these writing groups that are just so catty, like, oh God, it's wonderful. Like, it's a car crash you can't look away from, but cringy. Like, the whole thing just beginning to end had me cringing.
You know, I think part of it for people who aren't a part of writers groups, I've done a number of directing projects within writers, like retreats. I've learned that, like, by virtue of the feedback that is encouraged around people's work, a culture of cattiness just comes out, because I think it's both protective, you know, around a really delicate situation, which is like, critique my work so that I can improve. But for me, like, bad art friend is also like, where do you put the emphasis? Is it bad art friend or bad art friend? Yeah. Right? Like, and some of this is like, you know, and I think there's a bit of genius in the double entendre as it relates to this article, because, you know, I think you kind of circled around this, Colin, right? The short story is kind of bad art too.
Yeah.
And then the question of, like, are these women actually friends? And then what does it mean to be a bad art friend, right? Like, can you be in a group text about a single person in your art collective and be a good art friend? You know, can you give real meaningful critique, like, hey, you literally stole my Facebook post, and still be considered a friend? And are you a friend if you go, yeah, I totally did it's not going anywhere, or no, I totally did not.
What are you talking about, girl?
I think there's, you know, I think there's two parts of this that are being played out. And the part that I think I'm most interested in is like the bad art friend, you know, because making art is a collective activity, because ideas are not, are most often not a single source, right? So how do we protect each other and ourselves individually within the question around ownership and still be good friends to each other while making good art, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things to unpack here. And I do feel as though, once again, to make a Papoulian jump back to Squid Game, this is about people fighting over scraps in some ways. You know,
right.
I mean, this isn't a fight between, you know, Annie Dillard and John Updike. You know, this is a fight between, you know, and I've sort of, I don't know. I mean, I think these writers groups are, as you say, they are a little bit Squid Game-like. You know, some of us are going to survive and some of us are going to perish. And I want to make sure I'm in the former group. I think as your career goes on, again, I'm pretty old here. I don't know. I don't see writers, if you've been published a few times and stuff like that, writers get a lot less vicious, I think, under those circumstances. I think part of the problem is, you know, the career itself, it's really much harder these days to be, you know, the next, you know, Laurie Moore or whoever. I just don't think the money's there that there used to be and everything. So what are you fighting over at this point? Well, it's these other slights and stuff like that. So,
well, ironically, I think all of this scandal is going to be the best thing that happened to either one of these women's careers.
Right.
Like, everyone is talking about them. Nobody knew who Dawn Dorland or Sonia Larsson was last week. But now it's like you type D into Google and the first thing that comes up is Dawn Dorland. Like,
right.
Good for you, girl.
Yeah. And everybody's either Team Dawn or Team Sonia,
yeah.
Or Team as
Team Teresa. Neither. Yeah. I mean, they're both awful.
Oh, they're both bad.
Right. A couple of interesting pieces about it. Katie Waldman, writing in The New Yorker, actually spent some time on the short story itself and says it's not a good short story. But she makes some other interesting points about this. I think the most comprehensive and maybe a little bit easier to read piece as opposed to the New York Times is by a guy named Michael Hobbs, I think. He has a blog called Rotten in Denmark. And it's the title of the piece is Identifying the Bad Art Friend is Easy. And to me, that this was sort of a good explainer that because Kolker, the guy who wrote the New York Times piece, he kind of tells it out of sequence a little bit. And it's long and kind of hard to work the whole thing out.
He's apparently a true crime writer, which makes a lot more sense with the way he laid it out.
Right. Well, so Rebecca, I'm amazed that the Big Little Podcast hasn't pounced on this.
Oh, trust me.
For
I'll
season eight
it.
Or whatever it's going to be is, you know, instead of talking about TV shows, this is it. This is like, you know, as you said.
That's going to be the most meta season of Big Little Podcast ever.
Right. The moment you guys were made for. Okay. We got to go to break right here. I'm with Tanisha Dugan and Rebecca Castellani. We'll come back. We'll make some recommendations to you. We are back. This is The Nose. And we are fortunate to have us with us today, Tanisha Dugan and Rebecca Castellani as our panelists. Kat Pastor is the technical producer here. She is my hero this week. She has worked so hard during this pledge drive to keep things going. And we would be lost without her. And she desperately, desperately needs a cat nap. And so presumably she's going to get one this afternoon. Meanwhile, Lily Tyson, the newly crowned senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show, produced this episode. Thanks to you, Lily, and now Tanisha. And Rebecca, going to make some recommendations to you. Tanisha, what have you got for us this week?
So I'm going to do something that's like semi-political, which is not usually my bent, but you know, it's crazy times out here. So I'm actually going to endorse unions.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to endorse, especially coming out of a show like Squid Games and probably the article about those two writers, having a group of people working collectively towards the greater good is a good thing. And so I'm going to endorse my friends in IATSE who are fighting a big fight right now. But I'm going to endorse unions across the board. thank you for 40-hour work weeks and weekends. And there's more work to be done. So I hope we see more of you in the coming future. And I'm going to endorse The Smith, which is a restaurant across the street from Lincoln Center. I've been spending a lot of time there the past 2 months. And I've watched that neighborhood go from no Lincoln Center operating to Lincoln Center creakingly reopening, and to have a restaurant like The Smith that has been a place to go to, vaccinated and all, has been really lovely. It sort of harkened me back to times when one would go eat a meal and see some art. And while I don't think we're back, I think we're finding our way back. And so endorsing The Smith and the folks who give us behind the scenes work that we may not always see.
Yeah, that's good. That's a great endorsement. And how about you, Rebecca? What have you got to recommend to us?
So I actually just thought of this as we were talking about Bad Art Friend, but there is a fantastic dark book I read this summer called Bunny by a writer named Mona Awad.
I read it too, by the way.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I loved it. And it deals with a writer's group, a very dark writer's group. They all call each other Bunny. But it's if you've been, like I have, immersed in the Bad Art Friend cinematic universe, this belongs in that conversation. And my other endorsement is I just started watching for the first time Sex Education on Netflix, and it is absolutely fantastic. Gillian Anderson is my queen. It is just funny, intelligent, well-written. The costumes are fantastic. It's just a really, really great series. And if you've got young people in your life that have questions about sex, it's a great resource.
All right.
I'll add a thumbs up to that one too.
All right. I haven't tackled it yet. So I'm going to recommend kind of, what I'm going to do is recommend on HBO Max, if you scroll down, they don't really feature it up very much, but they have a whole separate TCM, Turner Classic Movie kind of sub-channel there. And a lot of what they think of as a classic doesn't really strike me as a classic either because of its recency or quality. But picking out maybe, you know, I've got somebody who has returned to my life from a long 10 and a half month medical odyssey, and she's home with me, but also needs things to kind of distract her right now. And so it was 2 days ago, I set up a comedy, the kind of troika, starting with Best in Show, then moving to Bowfinger, which is a very overlooked Steve Martin comedy with an incredible double performance by Eddie Murphy. If you've never seen this movie, I'm amazed it's not on everybody's top 10 lists. And then ending with Heaven Can Wait, which is wonderful. But you know, check out the menu there and pick some wonderful things to watch and sit down with somebody you love and do that. And meanwhile, thanks so much to Rebecca Castellani. And to Tanisha Dugan and to everybody else who helped out with the show. Now, when people ask you to pledge, please do that.
Yeah. It's cozy, like a Cracker Barrel. Yeah, we all be laughing, talking, joking, talking about this and talking about that. And talk about everything as a matter of fact. Oh, yeah. Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah, 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 yeah.